hand. "Please walk me downstairs to the subway or to a cab." "What happened, honey?" she asked. "They tried to do it to me," I cried. The woman looked at me and then at the boy. "You wait there for a minute, honey," she said. Then she and her husband came out. "Don't worry. Nothing's going to happen to you now." They brought me downstairs and put me into a cab. I thought a lot about those boys after that night. I hated them, but I couldn't understand why they hated me so much. Everybody was always saying what a dog-eat-dog world it was. There were all kinds of people in the world, and most of them seemed unhappy. Everybody seemed to be in their own bag, and few seemed to care about anybody else. I read this play by Sartre. The play ended with the conclusion that hell is other people, and for a while, I agreed. Back then, when I was growing up, boys gang-banging or gang-raping a girl was a pretty common thing. They called it pulling a train. It didn't happen to any particular kind of girl. It happened to girls who were at the wrong place at the wrong time. The boys talked about it like it was a joke or a game, like they were only out to have some fun. If a girl was caught on the wrong side of a park or in the wrong territory or on the wrong street, she was a target. It was a common thing back then for boys to downgrade girls and cuss at them in the street. It was common for them to go to bed with girls and talk about them like dogs the next day. It was common for boys to deny they were the fathers of their babies. And it was common for boys to beat girls up and knock them around. And then the girls would get hard, too. "If the nigga ain't got no money, I don't want to be bothered. If the nigga ain't got no car, then later for him." The more I watched how boys and girls behaved, the more I read and the more I thought about it, the more convinced I became that this behavior could be traced directly back to the plantation when slaves were encouraged to take the misery of their lives out on each other instead of on the master. The slave masters taught us we were ugly, less than human, unintelligent, and many of us believed it. Black people became breeding animals, studs and mares. A black woman was fair game for anyone at any time. The master or visiting guest or any redneck who desired her. A slave master would order her to have 6 with this stud, 7 with that, for the purpose of increasing his stock. She was considered less than a woman. She was a cross between a whore and a workhorse. Black men internalized the white man's opinion of black women. And if you ask me, a lot of us still act like we're back on the plantation with Massa pulling the strings. After my close call uptown, I became more skeptical of everybody. I was much more careful about the situations that I let myself fall into. I would talk to the men at Tony's, but more and more, I became strictly business. The more I saw of street life, the uglier it was. One day I was walking down 8th Street. I saw one of my aunt's friends. Her name was Abby or Addie or something like that, and she was big as a truck. I turned my head, hoping she wouldn't recognize me. "Joey? Joey!" I heard her cry out. I kept walking. She kept calling. I kept walking. Then I felt her grab my arm. "I know you," she said. "You're Joey. Your aunt and your mother are worried to death about you."
"I don't know what you're talking about," I said. "My name's Joyce, and I don't know you or anyone else that you're talking about."
"Come off it, Joey," she said. "You're not fooling me. Come with me while I call your aunt."
She had my arm in an iron grip. I thought of making a run for it, but she was too big to play with. She took me to some bar and told me to sit at the counter while she made the call. As soon as she started dialing, I made a beeline for the door. She was right on top of me, grabbing me with that iron grip.
"You're not going anywhere until your aunt gets down here."
In half an hour, Evelyn was on the scene, throwing questions at me left and right.
"Where have you been? What have you been doing? Where have you been staying? What have you been doing for money? How have you been eating?" she asked,
and a million questions more. When Evelyn questioned me, she sounded like a lawyer cross-examining a witness. In about an hour, I broke down and told her everything. She demanded that I take her to the hotel where I was staying. After I had packed my things, she told the guy behind the desk,
"Do you know that you've had a 13-year-old girl staying here? I could have you prosecuted for contributing to the delinquency of a minor."
The guy looked at me like he just couldn't believe it. I could have crawled under the floor. Then she called up Tony's and told him the same thing. I was dying of embarrassment, but in a way, I was glad it was over. I was getting tired of the streets. I was tired of being grown, and I wanted to be a kid again. Chapter 7. Kamau and I were acquitted in the bank robbery trial in the Southern District of New York on January 28, 1973, and on the following day, I was returned to New Jersey. When I arrived at the Morristown jail, there was a clump of reporters and photographers standing around. Morristown looked just like small-town USA. The jail was an ugly building attached to the courthouse. There were a few other women in the jail, and I was kept away from them. The only time I saw them was when I was being taken to or from my cell. They all appeared to be white, although I found out later that one was black. The guards were all women, as old as the hills, and they had been working at the jail for an eternity. There was a television and a radio in the cell, and it had been so long since I had been able to watch the news on television or listen to a static-free radio station that I went crazy, and I had turned into a crochet fiend. My poor mother was the unfortunate recipient of my early creations. Brave, devoted person that she was, she thought they were pure genius. We learned there were few, if any, black jurors on the panel for the new trial. The news was depressing. The panel was selected from the voting rolls, and since candidates running for office seldom represent the interests of black and poor people, blacks and the poor don't vote. But failing to vote means they don't sit on juries. Any chance that we would receive something even remotely resembling a fair trial was slim. We decided to try to have the trial removed to federal court. The chance of the feds taking over was slim, but it was worth the try. If the trial was held in federal court in Newark, at least we'd be assured of a few more black jurors on the jury panel. There were countless joint legal meetings, countless strategy sessions, and countless court appearances. My first look at the Morris County jury panel flung me into a terrible depression. There were only two or three black jurors on each panel, and they looked like extras in a soap opera. As a matter of fact, the whole jury panel looked like escapees from a soap opera. They dressed differently and had a whole different air about them than New York people. Morristown was supposed to be one of the 10 richest counties in the country, and looking at these people, I believed it. I could just see trying to explain to them what poor black people in big cities go through. How could they understand someone becoming a black revolutionary? They had so little to revolt against. They had bought the American dream lock, stock, and barrel, and seemed unaware that, for the majority of black and third world people, the American dream is the American nightmare. Evelyn and I had resolved our differences, and she was back on the case. She, Ray Brown, and Charles McKinney, Sundiata's lawyer, worked hard on the motion to remove the trial to federal court. But after a hearing, the federal judge remanded the case back to the state court. He hadn't even listened to our arguments, so we were right back where we started, picking a jury in Morris County. Jury selection droned on tediously. Sundiata and I kept ourselves from falling asleep or from having nervous breakdowns by laughing and talking. Just seeing Sundiata every day was such a comfort to me. We made up all kinds of little games and jokes, especially guessing the answers jurors would give to the trial judge's questions. We got to be pretty good at it. We could look at a person and pretty much know what he was going to say. Some glared at us hatefully while they waited to be called, as if they couldn't wait to give their opinion that we were guilty. They were so sure of exactly what happened. They recited detail after detail from newspapers and TV. "Where were you hiding that night on the turnpike?" I wanted to scream at them. "I didn't see you." Others gave us crooked smiles in the hope that we would think they sympathized with us and would leave them on the jury. But there was not one bigot in the courtroom. None of them said they had any prejudice against black people. "Do you have any black friends?" the judge asked. Of course. But when asked if they ever invited a black person to their homes or been to the home of a black person, the answer was invariably no. On one panel, the judge asked everybody if they ever called a black person a nigger. They all said no, except for one woman, who said, "Well, when I was a child, we used to say, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, catch a nigger by the toe." After that, a whole bunch of them said the same thing. Sometimes their answers were so phony, they were a joke. Except the joke was on us. One day, a man being questioned told the judge what he had read about the case in newspapers and what he had heard on radio and TV. He tried to make it seem that he had just incidentally come across the news stories and that he had not really followed the case or paid much attention to it. Further, he denied having been affected by any of it. Have you ever read a book called Target Blue? Only a day or two before, the defense team had asked that that question be included in their voir dire. Robert Daly, who at one time was the public relations and publicity director for the New York City Police Department, had written the book Target Blue. An excerpt from the book was coincidentally printed in New York Magazine on almost the exact day our trial was to begin. One or two chapters were about the Black Liberation Army. The book was a collection of sensationalism, groundless accusations, and outright lies. The few facts that were in those two chapters were distorted beyond recognition. I was referred to by name. Daly implied that I had been responsible for the deaths of numerous policemen. He called me the soul of the Black Liberation Army, the mother hen that kept them fighting and kept them moving. According to the book, I had also robbed numerous banks and blown up a police car with a hand grenade during a police chase. "Have you ever read Target Blue?" the judge asked.
Yes.
Immediately, the defense team submitted requests to the judge that additional questions be asked. "When did you read this book?"
"As a matter of fact, I'm reading it now."
Not only had he been reading the book, but he had it upstairs in the jury room. Although the defense team asked for an investigation, the judge refused. It was obvious the man had brought the book to court to show the other jurors and that they had discussed it. After a lot of arguments made by our lawyers, the judge agreed to dismiss that juror and others in the panel with whom he had been close. One day I was informed that the Nazi party was demonstrating outside the court, marching up and down, complete with swastikas, brown uniforms, and helmets. They carried white power, save our police, and death penalty placards. Other signs were printed with racist statements. Rumor spread that a cross had been burned in front of the home of one of our supporters. At the end of the day, the Nazis almost got into a fight with some of the black residents in Morristown. A lot of people don't know it, but they've got more Nazis and Ku Klux Klan in Jersey than a little bit. Some of my friends call it up south. Lou Myers, who was later one of my lawyers on this case, is from Mississippi. One day, in all earnestness, he told me he would rather try a case in Mississippi any day than try one in Jersey. I couldn't understand it. I was growing weaker and weaker. My energy seemed to have gone down the drain. All I wanted to do was sleep. I chided myself for trying to escape from reality instead of facing it. I had seen women in jail sleep their whole time away. I was afraid that was happening to me. I was so easily upset and reacted to everything in an exaggerated manner. My nerves were terrible. Every little thing affected me. All I did all day when there was no court was sleep, eat, watch television, and listen to the radio. I was eating like food was going out of style. This also convinced me my nerves were going bad. I have seen people in prison gain 20, 30, 40, 50 pounds eating out of nerves and boredom. It gets to the point when all you have to look forward to is the meals. And that in itself is pitiful because anyone who has ever been in prison knows how terrible the food is. Yet I was gulping that stuff down just like it was Mom's home cooking. It wasn't until I sat down one day to do my exercises that I really suspected what could be wrong. I could barely get through 10 sit-ups. Everything added up. I didn't dare hope, but at the same time, down deep inside, I knew. As sure as I knew my own name, I knew that I was pregnant. But what was I to do next? I knew I had to see the doctor. But what in the world was I going to say? I had been in prison for 8 months, and it would really be weird to say, "Hey, I think I'm pregnant." I wanted to know for sure whether I was or not, but if I wasn't, I didn't want the doctor to know my business. Because if I was, it would be only a matter of time before the whole world would know. The first thing the next morning, I saw the prison doctor. I told him all my symptoms, dropping hint after hint. He told me there was nothing to worry about, that I was just constipated. As time wore on, it became harder and harder to wake up in the morning. When the guards came to wake me for court, I would simply roll over and continue sleeping. They did everything to get me out of bed. They called, they threatened, they banged on the bars, and anything else they could think of. "Just don't come in this cell," I would tell them, feeling evil as the day is long. "You come in here and put your hands on me, and I'm gonna take your head right off of your shoulders." They must have known I meant it because they kept their distance until I was awake. I didn't care what they thought or said, as long as they didn't put their hands on me. I wanted them to leave me alone. All I wanted to do was sleep. I walked into court whenever I got up, no matter what time it was. The judge would go on and on about my lateness and admonish my lawyers for not having me in court on time, but it was hopeless. I didn't care what the judge said, what the guard said, or what anybody said. All I wanted to do was sleep. I told Sundiata and one or two of the lawyers that I thought I was pregnant. They looked at me blankly, puzzled, as if I had an overactive imagination. Each day I felt more and more weird. I felt fragile and sick. I went back to the prison doctor, dropping more and more hints. I repeated my symptoms. Queasy stomach getting bigger, sick in the mornings, sleep all the time, etc. But he still didn't get the message and kept telling me this stuff about an intestinal disorder. I didn't know what to do next. One day I woke up and could hardly move. I was sick as a dog and dizzy to boot. I got up for a minute, then sank back down on the cot, holding on to it for dear life. They called the prison doctor. I repeated the symptoms again, and this time he ordered some tests. He asked for a urine specimen. I was sure he had sent for a pregnancy test. I waited a few days and heard nothing. Then the nurse came and asked me for more urine. I was certain this meant the pregnancy test was positive, and they were retesting just to be sure. I gave her the urine sample and waited. When the doctor called me to his office, I knew he was going to tell me I was pregnant. Instead, he was smug and acted really on the stupid side. He kept making snide little remarks, and I could tell he was trying to make fun of me. I asked him what was wrong with me, and he repeated the same old stuff about a bowel disorder. Then he asked me some questions about my sex life. "Ask your mama about her sex life," I said, and went out of his office, slamming the door. Later that day, Ray Brown and Evelyn came to see me. Ray was in a jovial mood, laughing his head off. "Well, you've really done it this time. I don't know what we're gonna do with you. His Honor is going to give you a strong reprimand for getting pregnant during his trial."
"You mean I'm really pregnant?"
"It was the doctor's report to the judge. Didn't you know?"
"No," I told him.
"I was just in that slimy bastard's office this morning, and he told me that I had something wrong with my intestines."
"He's pulling your leg," Ray said.
"They did 2 or 3 pregnancy tests on you, and they all came back positive." "You're pregnant, all right." "I can't believe it." Evelyn was in a state of shock. "It's something," she said. Then she looked into space for a long time. "It's something." "Judge Bachman is having a fit," Ray said. I hear the FBI is going to conduct an investigation to determine how you got pregnant.
Well, they better not try to come round me asking no questions, I told them. I'll tell them that this baby was sent by the black creator to liberate black people.
I'll tell them that this baby is the new black messiah, conceived in a holy way, come to lead our people to freedom and justice and to create a new black nation.
Sundiata and McKinney had joined us. Sundiata was elated. He couldn't get over it. He sat there grinning and slapping his knee. I think it's beautiful, he kept saying. I think it's absolutely beautiful. Everyone was in a jubilant mood. I was glad. I hadn't known how they would react.
It's amazing, Evelyn said. Out of all this misery, a new life is conceived.
I was caught up in the mood, but I couldn't wait to get off alone in my cell to think about this. What had seemed like a remote dream was coming true. A baby. My mind was jumping and dancing.
I spent the next few days in a virtual daze, a joyous daze. A person was inside of me. Someone who is going to grow up to walk and talk, to love and laugh. To me, it was the miracle of all miracles, and deeply spiritual. The odds against this baby being conceived were so great, it boggled my mind. And yet it was happening. It seemed so right, so beautiful, in surroundings that were so ugly. I was filled with emotion. Already I was deeply in love with this child. Already I talked to it and worried about it and wondered how it was feeling and what it was thinking. I would lie in my cell wondering about his or her life, wondering what kind of life it would have, what kind of people it would love, what kind of values it would have, and what it would think of all the madness that would surround it. Sometimes I felt so helplessly protective, wondering when my baby would be called nigger for the first time, wondering when the full horror and degradation of being black in America would descend on my baby. How many wolves hid behind the bushes to eat my child? But there were so many happy things that I thought about, too. I wondered when would be the first time my child would sit down and seriously appreciate the glory of a sunset and marvel at the wonders of nature. Or when he or she would smack lips and lick fingers over a sweet potato pie or kiss strawberries and drink lemonade. It has always intrigued me how the world can be so beautiful and so ugly at the same time. I wanted, with all my being, for my baby to experience the many types and sides of love and friendship, and to know and understand selflessness and generosity, struggle and sacrifice, honesty, courage, and so many of the sentiments that have given me strength and have made my life worth living. In these days, I was in such a state of sensitivity and thought that I barely noticed what was going on around me. The next time my mother came to see me, my sister was with her. I was so happy to see them both. When I say see, it is something of an overstatement because in Morristown Jail, there are little windows that you and your visitors peek through, and there are little holes through which you are supposed to talk. But to make yourself heard, you are obliged to shout.
Honey, you look pale, my mother shouted. Mommy, I'm pregnant. What is it, honey? I'm pregnant, Mommy.
My mother smiled blandly. I repeated myself and she began to laugh.
How many months are you?
No, seriously, Mommy, I'm pregnant.
Well, so am I, my mother said, this time laughing heartily. I think it was my hysterectomy that caused it.
No, Mommy, I pleaded.
You don't understand. I'm pregnant. I'm not joking.
Who's joking, honey? Pregnancy is a serious matter, she said, trying to keep a straight face.
Especially when the baby is born under immaculate conception and God is the father.
She and my sister were having a giggling fit.
What are you gonna name the baby? My sister added. Jesus?
They just carried on. The more I insisted I was pregnant, the more they laughed and cracked jokes. Finally, my mother stopped laughing. Are you really pregnant? I told her that it happened in the court and that Kamal was the father.
How do you feel?
Actually, kind of funny, I told her. I can barely move and I'm just so tired. In the visiting room on the prisoner's side, there were no chairs, so you had to stand up and talk. I was so tired, I just couldn't stand any longer. I sat down on the floor, leaning on the wall behind me so that they could see me. I couldn't see them, but we shouted to each other until the visit was over. I went up to my cell after the visit ended and immediately fell out. My mother went to the warden to complain about their refusal to provide chairs. The next day, Evelyn came to see me. Your mother called me last night all the way from Morristown as soon as she left you. She was worried to death that, with all you've been through, you'd finally been driven crazy. I told her not to worry, that you are in fact pregnant. I think she's in a state of shock. So is your sister. It's all over the papers. I brought them for you. I couldn't believe it. Sure enough, there were the articles. The one in the New York Daily News, I remember, was especially sordid. All of the papers speculated about who the father was and how I had managed to become pregnant in jail. One of them hinted that a prison guard was the father. I'm sick, Auntie. I feel awful. Well, that's what happens when you're pregnant. You get morning sickness and all sorts of other strange ailments. It's only normal. Maybe you're right, but I'm having these pains down here, I told her, pointing to where the pains were. And I can barely stand up. She told me to go see the doctor, and I told her how the doctor had acted. Well, go see him anyway and have him examine you thoroughly. Meanwhile, I'll try to have you seen by a private gynecologist as soon as possible. I'll probably have to go to court. She promised that she would do all that she could to get an outside doctor, and I went upstairs to see the jail doctor. Why did you lie to me and tell me all that junk about a bowel disorder was the first thing I asked him. Well, you lied. I just figured I'd get back at you. Anyway, you found out like I knew you would. I told him about my pains and he examined me. What's wrong? I asked anxiously. There's a chance you're threatening to abort. What? I practically screamed. There's a chance that you're going to abort. I don't want no abortion, I cried out. It's probably the best course you could take now, and I'd recommend it. But that's not what I was talking about. I said that there was a chance you could spontaneously abort, have a miscarriage. Oh, no, I moaned. What are you going to do? Relax, it's probably nothing serious. It's nothing much to worry about. What do you mean, nothing much to worry about? I want this baby. Well, I can't force you to do anything, but my advice is to have an abortion. It would be better for you and for everyone else. I don't want nobody's abortion. But what are you going to do about this miscarriage thing? Isn't there something you can give me to keep me from having a miscarriage? Isn't there something that I can take to make sure I don't lose this baby? No, there's nothing I can do now. We have to wait and see what happens. What do you mean, wait and see what happens? If I have a miscarriage, then it will be too late. Can't you call a gynecologist? No, there's nothing I can do right now. You mean there's nothing you will do right now, don't you? Take it any way you want to. Won't you at least call a gynecologist in to see me? You're not a specialist in this area. I don't need you to tell me what my specialties are, he said angrily. It would be best for everybody concerned if you have an abortion, no matter which way you have it. Just who is everybody concerned? Don't you worry about it. My advice to you is that you should go to your cell and lie down. Just lie down and rest your mind. Just lie down and stay off your feet. And if you go to the bathroom and see a lump in the toilet, don't flush it. It's your baby. I raced out of his office, and when I got to my cell, I lay on the cot crying. I was worried to death. As far as I could see, they were out to kill my baby. I couldn't lose this baby now, not now. It was meant to be. This baby was our hope for the future. I tried to calm myself. I didn't want the baby to feel my anguish. Finally, I fell asleep. The next morning, I waited anxiously for Evelyn and Ray Brown. Ray came first. I told him what had happened. Please, I begged, get a doctor we can trust to see me today. I'll try to get one as soon as I can, Ray assured me. I'll have to make some phone calls, and then I've got to talk to the judge. He's having a fit, you know. He wants to resume the trial today. Don't worry. Everything's going to be all right. Ray and Evelyn came back in about an hour. Don't worry, they told me. The trial has been postponed until there is a report from our doctor. The judge has permitted you to be examined by your own gynecologist, and he's coming this afternoon, so cheer up. They did their best to take my mind off everything and to make me feel better. That day, I felt worse than ever before. Is the doctor black? No, he's a Ku Klux Klan doctor, Ray Brown joked. I felt like my insides were going to drop to the floor at any minute. Ray went outside to meet the doctor and came back followed by a tall, brown-skinned man. The man sure as hell didn't look like no doctor. He looked like Mr. Superfly himself. He had on a long fur coat, a jumpsuit, and platform shoes. But when I looked into his face, I was reassured. He was very kind and very self-assured. He was gentle, and when he examined me, I was truly grateful. He asked a whole lot of questions in a careful, painstaking manner. I was really impressed. Would you tell me your name again? I asked him, ashamed that I had forgotten it. Sure, that's an easy order. Ernest Wyman Garrett. He practiced in Newark, and there was an air of Newark about him. I liked him instantly. He was one of those rare breed of black professionals who haven't lost contact with the masses of black people. He didn't have one trace of the affected, bougie speech and mannerisms that are so popular among the black middle class. I waited nervously for the verdict. There's no doubt about it. You're pregnant. But I found blood in the vaginal canal, which can be a sign that something is wrong. There's a possibility that you are threatening to abort. This doesn't mean that you're going to have a miscarriage. The chances are good that you won't. The odds in medical statistics are in your favor. He explained the different possibilities in the treatment he was prescribing. I asked a million questions, and when he left, felt a whole lot better just knowing there was someone I could trust taking care of me and the baby. The days that followed are blurry in my mind. Most of the time I slept. The warden and the sheriff, and the powers that were, didn't like the idea of my having my own doctor, though. In their minds, the butcher, jailhouse, quack house doctor was good enough for me. And the fact that Dr. Garrett was black infuriated them. They refused to let him examine me unless a white doctor, hired by the state, was present. And for the report to the judge, the white doctor had to examine me. Fortunately, he agreed with my doctor's findings. There was a lot of activity going on around me that I didn't understand. I was too out of it to try. I could see, though, that Evelyn and Ray were worried. I wanted to help them to get to the bottom of what was happening, but I just didn't have the energy. About 2 days after his first visit, Dr. Garrett came to visit me. When he finished examining me, he said, "Asada, I don't want to worry you, but I think you should be hospitalized. It's nothing serious, strictly a precautionary measure. You're in no condition to proceed with the trial. You need a few weeks of complete bed rest. There is a possibility the judge will try to push you into that trial right away without regard for your medical condition. Asada, there is no way we are going to let that happen. I am prepared to fight all the way for your right as a human being to receive decent medical care and for your baby to be born healthy. I'm doing the same for you as I would for any other patient. You should be hospitalized. There isn't a responsible doctor in the world who wouldn't agree with that opinion. And I'm prepared to testify in any court to deny you proper medical care would be tantamount to committing murder. I will be going in a very short time to give a medical report about your condition to the judge. I will do my best to convince him of the seriousness of this matter. I think he'll listen to reason. I'm sure the judge will go along with the findings of two board-certified gynecologists. But if worse comes to worst, and the judge denies our motion, I will see to it personally that this jail and the courtroom are surrounded by the right-to-life people by tomorrow morning. I was too shot out to say much more than thank you. I was scared to death for my baby, but I knew that everything that could be done was being done, and that was a load off my mind. I got dressed and waited for them to come and take me to court. I wanted to hear what was going on. When they didn't come for me, I became worried. What was going on? Why weren't they bringing me to court? Why were they taking so long? What were they going to do? Were they going to try to make me go to trial like this? What were they planning to do? Evelyn and Ray came in strutting and beaming. I knew everything was going to be all right. What happened? Why didn't they bring me to court? You're too sick to go to court, Evelyn laughed. Haven't you heard they don't let pregnant women into court? They figured it's a disease and are afraid everybody will catch it. We felt it was much better for you not to be moved. It went fine. They'll be taking you to a hospital as soon as they can make the arrangements. Dr. Garrett did a great job. After that speech, there was no way the judge was going to force you to go to trial in your condition. The trial has been severed, and Sundiata will go on with the trial alone. What? I exclaimed. But we had agreed that we would be tried together. Why can't they wait until I'm better? Now, Asada, you know they're not going to wait for you to have your baby to try Sundiata. They claim that being here in Morristown is costing them a fortune. It will be cheaper if they try us together, I said. Well, can't I at least see Sundiata and say goodbye to him? We'll try, they said, but we doubt if there will be time or if the sheriff will consent to it. I'm going to miss Sundiata. Yes, we know. Later, they put me on a stretcher and wheeled me into an ambulance. Don't worry, I told the baby. You're going to be all right. Love. Love is contraband in hell because love is an acid that eats away bars. But you, me, and tomorrow hold hands and make vows that struggle will multiply. The hacksaw has two blades. The shotgun has two barrels. We are pregnant with freedom. We are a conspiracy. Chapter 8. After the village, I lived with Evelyn on 80th Street between Amsterdam and Columbus in Manhattan. She had a garden apartment in a brownstone. Nothing grew in the garden but weeds, and it was where our neighbors threw their garbage. The apartment was one big room that we used for sleeping, eating, and living. It had a kitchen and a bathroom with an old-fashioned toilet up on a platform and an overhead tank so that you had to pull on a little chain to flush it. Evelyn always referred to it as the dump. She had it fixed up nicely, but it was just too small for two people, especially if one of them was me. I was a slob, and Evelyn went to great pains to train me in neatness. In a small place like that, when just a few things are out of place, it looks like a hurricane passed through. And many times, after a long day's work, poor Evelyn would be greeted with a hurricane, a tornado, and an earthquake at the same time. Gradually, I learned to keep things in something vaguely resembling order. The neighborhood for me was exciting, full of character and different flavors. Central Park and Riverside Park were nearby, and I immediately fell in love with both of them. Then, also, there were plenty of museums nearby. I spent hour upon hour in the Museum of Natural History and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They were free then and full of fascinating things. There were all kinds of stores for me to explore and examine, even though most of the time I didn't have any money. I was delighted with it all, and it was my first clear glimpse of the hierarchy of American society. 80th Street, like many of the nearby streets, was changing. Most of the changing, however, had taken place before I got there. Most of the Germans had moved out, and blacks and Puerto Ricans were moving in. Evelyn told me that when she moved there, it was so safe she had slept in the summer with the back door open and just the screen door latched. On 80th Street, there might be 3, 4, 5 or more people huddled into a one-room apartment. Sometimes the apartments were rented furnished with nothing but an old, saggy bed, a chest of drawers, and a beat-up refrigerator and stove. You could usually tell them from the outside by the paper-thin plastic curtains shimmying in the wind. Most of the people on 80th Street were poor, although here and there were a few renovated apartments that catered to a clientele that was a little richer, usually night people. 79th Street was directly behind us, but there was a world of difference between the two. It was an upper-middle-class street. Doctors and lawyers and a lot of performers lived there, Every day after school, I would hear an opera singer practicing. Maybe that's why I developed a profound dislike for opera. The people on 79th Street wouldn't dream of socializing with the people on 80th Street. They recognized our existence with a mixture of amusement, fear, and dislike. 81st Street between Central Park West and Columbus Avenue was even richer. The lobbies were elegant, and the doormen were splendidly attired. They were, for the most part, all white and not even slightly aware of the people who lived only a block away. Farther over toward the river, near West End Avenue or Riverside Drive, there was a middle-class neighborhood. The buildings were usually old, grandiose, and well-kept. The people who lived there were mostly white, of course, with a few blacks and mixed couples thrown in. The Upper West Side, as the neighborhood was called, was supposed to be a liberal stronghold. I have never really understood exactly what a liberal is, though, since I have heard liberals express every conceivable opinion on every conceivable subject. As far as I can tell, you have the extreme right, who are fascists, racist, capitalist dogs like Ronald Reagan, who come right out and let you know where they're coming from. And on the opposite end, you have the left, who are supposed to be committed to justice, equality, and human rights. And somewhere between those two points is the liberal. As far as I'm concerned, liberal is the most meaningless word in the dictionary. History has shown me that as long as some white middle-class people can live high on the hog, take vacations to Europe, and send their children to private schools and reap the benefits of their white skin privilege, then they are liberals. But when times get hard and money gets tight, they pull off that liberal mask and you think you're talking to Adolf Hitler. They feel sorry for the so-called underprivileged just as long as they can maintain their own privileges. Sometimes I walked over to the east side on the other side of Central Park. If Riverside Drive was like another city, then the east side was like another world. English nannies pushed fancy baby carriages, they called them prams, through the eastern side of Central Park. The only black people you saw were servants, or like me, those just passing through. Fifth Avenue, Park Avenue, chauffeur-driven cars, diamonds, and furs. The Upper East Side was for the show-nuff rich. When I walked through those streets, some looked at me as if I was an object from a museum or something. Once or twice, a doorman actually stopped me and asked me where I was going. But I kept walking and looking. Sometimes I'd have some fun and walk into one of the stores. I couldn't believe there were people who paid that kind of money for things. As soon as I'd step in, the salespeople were right on me. Sometimes I said I was just looking. Other times I would ask for outrageous things like pickled feet. Usually they would say, "What? What? What?" And I would burst out laughing. One time I went into a grocery store and was asked who my mistress was. I was always crazy about art and made it a point to visit any art gallery I discovered. Sometimes they acted snooty or disgusted. At first I felt uneasy and out of place, but after a while, whenever they acted disgusted, I made a point of asking the price of each piece. They would turn so red and swell up so much that it was comical. I remember hating some of those people, but at the same time, I wanted to be rich like them. Back then, I thought being rich was the solution to everything. Four blocks from where we lived, there was still another world, 84th Street between Amsterdam and Columbus. Before it was torn down, it was voted the worst block in the city. When I was a kid, I would never have imagined that people could live so bad. Living in some of those apartments was like living in a coffin. I swear there was one building that when you walked past it in the summer, it stunk so bad it made you want to drop to your knees. Usually I'd just sit on some stoop and watch the street. There was always something going on. Men standing around with do-rags on their heads, covering greasy processed hairdos, making deals, laughing and talking and looking at the women passing by. Drunks and fights and drunken fights. The street was always alive and swarming with people. Survival and life were hanging out in the open like laundry for everyone to see. Arguments, dirty deals, misery, and malice ran out into the streets like pus from open sores. There's something horrible and foreboding about the street, yet exciting at the same time. Lil Bit, who went to my school, lived on 84th Street. Her nickname was Lil Bit, but I called her Fruit Fly because she was crazy about fruit. I liked to hang out with her because she was a good walker. We could walk for hours without getting tired. One day, she asked me to come with her to get something from her house. When we got there, I couldn't believe it. I thought I had seen some messed up cribs before, but hers took the cake. She lived in a tiny little pea-green closet of a room, covered with wall-to-wall roaches. I just kept staring at Lil Bit. She walked around in that horror house like it was normal. She didn't even try to kill the roaches. She just brushed them aside if they got in her way. When I left, I itched and scratched for hours. When I met Lil Bit's mother and started getting to know her and some of her neighbors, I got my first lesson in hopelessness. Lil Bit's mother used to work in factories and laundries as a presser, but she burned her hand real bad and was on some kind of disability. She lived from day to day and from check to check. She was always sick, and sometimes her cough was so bad, I thought she was going to die any minute. She acted like she was too tired or too weak to do much of anything. They had a hot plate, but most of the time they didn't even cook. They just ate sandwiches, usually lunch meat on white bread. Lil Bit's mother never went anywhere except to the clinic or to the welfare office or to the bar on Amsterdam. Sometimes she would get drunk and start crying about some man she used to go with. She didn't know anything about what was going on in the world, and she didn't seem to care. 84th Street was her world, and other worlds didn't really exist. When I was with Lil Bit and her mother, I felt all kinds of things. Sometimes disgust and anger because they accepted anything and lived any old kind of way. Other times I felt sorry for them, and still other times I relaxed and enjoyed them because they were so easy and down to earth. But whenever I hung out with them, it was down on the stoop. I would never go up into that house. Evelyn kept my excursions at a bare minimum, though. She was strict and didn't play around. Every day after school, I had to be in the house by 4 o'clock, and she would call home just to see that I had arrived safely. Evelyn didn't want me in the street too much, because she said the neighborhood was bad and she didn't want me to get in any trouble. And she also wanted me to stay home and do my homework. After homework, I read. I've never been too fond of television, and besides, Evelyn had an excellent library. Those books were like food to me. Fiction and poetry were my favorites, although I liked history and psychology too. I also liked to read about other countries and about all the different religions in the world. The only books I never touched were Evelyn's law books. They were dry and boring and Greek to me. Evelyn was a store of knowledge, and she knew about a whole range of subjects. We were always discussing or debating something. Hanging out with Evelyn, I started to think that I was cool and sophisticated and grown up and that I knew it all. You couldn't tell me nothing. I was just too cool. Evelyn and I went to museums and art galleries and the theater. On Broadway, off Broadway, she was turning me on to so many things. I started to view movies as an art form instead of just entertainment. I was learning what and how to order at restaurants, and my vocabulary and control of the English language were expanding greatly. But life with Evelyn definitely had its ups and downs. Sometimes we got along famously, and other times it was terrible. Evelyn was super honest, and she just could not tolerate my lying. I would try to tell the truth and try to be honest, but sometimes, especially if I was in a tight situation, I would lie. I had been in the habit of lying, and it was easy for me to fall back into the old pattern. But it was futile to lie to Evelyn because she was a lawyer and would cross-examine me until I would inevitably trip myself up. Little by little, I got out of the habit, but it was a long and constant battle between us. Our financial situation also had its ups and downs. One week we were rich, and the next week we were poor. Evelyn was determined to be a trial lawyer and to be in private practice. Most of her clients were black and poor, and most of the time they didn't have money to pay her. But Evelyn would defend them anyway. She was always up in arms about some injustice or other. I used to call her the last angry woman, But whenever somebody did pay her, we were rich. We would go out and celebrate. For a week or so, we ate steaks and lamb chops, went to restaurants, took taxis. The next week, we would be right back to riding subways and eating hamburgers. Evelyn was generous and extravagant, and she had absolutely no head for business. I usually did the shopping for us since I was more tight-fisted and practical. Once in a while, I'd be tempted to give myself a 5-finger discount, but Evelyn was so honest that it rubbed off on me. I was becoming so goody-goody I couldn't stand myself. I really underwent a great change. Evelyn had great plans for my future. I was going to junior high school 44, but Evelyn wasn't satisfied with the education I was receiving. JHS 44 wasn't a bad school, but we were learning at a much slower pace than at my school in Queens. I don't remember too much about the school except for the music classes. Most of the class was black or Puerto Rican, and we all loved music. But we hated music class with a passion. The teacher talked to us as though we were inferior savages, incapable of appreciating the finer things in life. She lectured about symphonies and concertos and sonatas and the like in a snooty voice. A boy would mimic the gestures and expressions of the teacher, and the rest of us would giggle and snicker as she played music. The teacher became more and more exasperated, saying,
"Listen! Can't you listen? Don't you have ears? Can't you appreciate anything? I'm trying to get you to appreciate music, and you all act as though you're deaf. I want you to stop talking. I want you to stop talking and listen. Do you hear me?"
We got louder and louder, and the teacher became more and more disgusted. She would scream at us and call us names like hooligans and ignoramuses, and we returned her insults. We hated her because she thought the music she liked was so superior. She didn't recognize that we had our own music and that we loved music. For her, there was no other music except Bach and Beethoven and Mozart. To her, we were uncultured and uncouth. For her, Latin music, jazz, rhythm and blues were trashy and we were trash. She was a racist who would have denied it to the bitter end. A lot of people don't know how many ways racism can manifest itself, and in how many ways people fight against it. When I think of how racist, how Eurocentric our so-called education in America is, it staggers my mind. And when I think back to some of those kids who were labeled troublemakers and problem students, I realize that many of them were unsung heroes who fought to maintain some sense of dignity and self-worth. Evelyn strongly suggested that I enter Cathedral High School in the 9th grade. I was not at all happy about the idea since I hated wearing a uniform and Catholic schools had a reputation for being so strict. But Evelyn kept on strongly suggesting and I got the message. I didn't mind the Catholic religious part of it, though, since I was going to Mass regularly and I was kind of holy that year. I took the test for Cathedral and passed, and it was firm that I was going to enter Cathedral the next September. I even started to feel happy about it. It was a change, and I have always been a person who likes a change of scenery. I usually spent my weekends with one of my girlfriends or with my mother as much as possible. Tony was cool to hang out with, and she knew where all the parties were. But we never had deep conversations, so we never got really close. Bonnie I met through Tony and began what was to be a best friend relationship with an argument about Abraham Lincoln. We argued for hours until Bonnie's aunt told us to shut up and go to bed since neither of us knew what we were talking about. Bonnie lived in the same building my mother lived in, and after that night, we became close friends and talked about every subject on earth. Bonnie knew more than I did about what was happening in the world, and we spent hours talking about Medgar Evers, sit-ins, freedom riders, etc. We began to write poetry about love and black people, and sometimes we wrote morbid poetry about hate and death. As soon as we finished a poem, we'd call each other and read it. After a while, we read poetry together. Dorothy Parker and Edna St. Vincent Millay were our idols. We read everything they wrote and even memorized their poems. After that, we read all different kinds of poets. We were deep and were forever in the library or a bookstore trying to find another poet who was deep too. The more we read, the more we wrote. And it came in handy in the street. If we didn't like somebody or we had some dispute with someone, we wrote a poem about them. We made up all kinds of dozens of poems and laughed our heads off. We were young and old, happy and sad at the same time. Usually every summer I went down south to visit my grandparents. When they had the business on the beach, I loved it. But they had lost two different buildings on the beach, both destroyed by hurricanes. After the last one was leveled, they operated a restaurant on Red Cross Street. I liked working in the restaurant sometimes, but it wasn't as much fun as working on the beach. One of the last summers I spent down south, the NAACP rented a building a few doors from my grandparents' restaurant, which was a great source of interest to me. I was forever walking by, standing in the doorway, or sliding discreetly into the building to see what was going on. I could hear them talking about integrating the South by sitting in, praying in, singing in, and about nonviolence. I was glad because I surely wanted segregation to end. I had grown up exposed to the degrading, dehumanizing side of segregation. I remember that when we traveled from north to south and vice versa, we really felt the sting of segregation more acutely than at other times. We'd drive hours without being able to stop anywhere. Sometimes we would pull into a filthy old gas station, buy gas, and then be told that we were not permitted to use their filthy old bathroom because we were black. I can remember clearly squatting in the bushes with mosquitoes biting my bare buttocks and my grandmother handing me toilet paper, because we could not find a place with a colored bathroom. Sometimes we were hungry, but there was no place to eat. Other times we were sleepy, and there was no hotel or motel that would admit us. If I sit and add up all the colored toilets and drinking fountains in my life, and all of the back of the buses or the Jim Crow railway cars or the places I couldn't go, it adds up to one great ball of anger. And so when I saw these NAACP people, I was ready to do whatever it was they were going to do. But they were very confusing. One day I was hanging around in the office and two men were talking about nonviolence and self-control. Then he walked around the room asking everybody questions. What would you do if they pushed you? Nothing. I'd just keep on doing what I came to do. What would you do if they kicked you? I'd pray to the Lord to forgive them for their sins. What would you do if they spit on you? I'd just go on singing. Well, that was too much for me. I could take someone pushing me, hitting me, kicking me, but to sit there and let some crack-a-dog spit on me? Well, just the idea of it made me want to fight. To me, if someone spit on you, it was worse than hitting you, especially if they spit in your face. I tried to tell myself that I would just sit there and take it, but every muscle in my body, every instinct I had rebelled against it. The man continued around the room asking everybody the same questions. When he came to me, I answered the same too, except for the spitting question. I don't know, I told him. What do you mean you don't know? I just don't know. Well, little sister, we can see that you're just not ready. If you want your freedom, there's no sacrifice that's too big to make. Everybody looked at me as if I was some kind of stupid idiot. I felt bad, but I still couldn't get used to the idea of letting somebody spit on me. The man said I wasn't ready, and I had to agree with him. When I think back to those days, I feel such admiration and respect for the spirit of struggle and sacrifice that my people exhibited. They went up against white mobs, water hoses, vicious dogs, the Ku Klux Klan, trigger-happy, nightstick-wielding police armed only with their belief in justice and their desire for freedom. I remember how I felt in those days. I wanted to be an American just like any other American. I wanted a piece of America's apple pie. I believed we could get our freedom just by appealing to the consciences of white people. I believed that the North was really interested in integration and civil rights and equal rights. I used to go around saying, "Our country, our president, our government." When the national anthem was played or the Pledge of Allegiance spoken, I stood at attention and felt proud. I don't know what in the hell I was feeling proud about, but I felt the juice of patriotism running through my blood. I believed that if the South could only be like the North, then everything would be all right. I believed that we black people were really making progress and that the government, the president, the Supreme Court, and the Congress were behind us, so we couldn't go wrong. I believed that integration was really the solution to our problems. I believed that if white people could go to school with us, live next to us, work next to us, they would see that we were really good people and would stop being prejudiced against us. I believed that America was really a good country, like my teacher said in school, the greatest country on the face of the earth. I grew up believing that stuff, really believing it. And now, 20-odd years later, it seems like a bad joke. Nobody in the world, nobody in history, has ever gotten their freedom by appealing to the moral sense of the people who were oppressing them. Once you study and really get a good understanding of the way the system in the United States works, then you see, without a doubt, that the civil rights movement never had a chance of succeeding. White people, whether they are from the North or from the South, whether it was in 1960 or 1980, benefit from the oppression of black people. Those who believe that the president or the vice president and the Congress and the Supreme Court run this country are sadly mistaken. The almighty dollar is king. Those who have the most money control the country, and through campaign contributions, buy and sell presidents, congressmen, and judges, the ones who pass the laws and enforce the laws that benefit their benefactors. The rich have always used racism to maintain power, to hate someone, to discriminate against them, and to attack them because of their racial characteristics. Is one of the most primitive, reactionary, ignorant ways of thinking that exists. A war between the races would help nobody and free nobody and should be avoided at all costs. But a one-sided race war with black people as the targets and white people shooting the guns is worse. We will be criminally negligent, however, if we do not deal with racism and racist violence, and if we do not prepare to defend ourselves against it. Stranger. Everything you love is from a different world. Hungry, you turn your nose up at my peas and rice. Chapter 9. I was taken to Roosevelt Hospital in Metuchen, New Jersey, and shackled to the bed by my foot. Dr. Garrett had established that I was 1 month pregnant. When he visited me, he demanded that the shackles be removed at once, based on the elementary principle that proper treatment, both mental and physical, of a woman threatening miscarriage would not seem to include being chained to a bedpost. My mental stability was also threatened by the round-the-clock guards who sat outside my hospital room with shotguns trained at my head. After 10 days, I was discharged from the hospital over the objections of my doctor, brought to the Middlesex County Jail for Men, and kept in solitary confinement from February 1974 until May 1974. At first, they wouldn't even give me milk. Since pork served as a staple meat almost daily, I began to slowly starve. In county jails, it goes like this. One sheet, one horse blanket, a metal cup. Your cell is rated if you have luxuries, like salt. They did everything they could to thwart the care Dr. Garrett was trying to give me. They hired their own doctor and insisted that whenever my doctor saw me, their man had to be present. This meant a severe limitation on the number of visits Dr. Garrett could arrange because their doctor happened often not to make it out to the prison on the days examinations had been agreed to and scheduled. My lawyers had initiated a lawsuit against the state of New Jersey in federal court, charging medical maltreatment and dietary abuse. Before the date the hearing was scheduled, I was extradited to the state of New York, which made the federal court action moot. When I arrived at Rikers Island again, I was anemic and malnourished, according to my entrance physical. New Jersey had been giving me iron pills, but I was anemic up to the last blood test before giving birth. The pregnancy or special diet at Rikers, in addition to the regular food, was powdered milk, juice, and a hard-boiled egg daily. This was my diet until I gave birth, and things seemed to go normally. Meanwhile, the lawyers obtained another court order from the New York court permitting Dr. Garrett to continue treating me. When he first came to Rikers, I was in the infirmary. They told him the court order was no good, that he couldn't see me. I was left in a room for 3 days with a woman who turned out later to have active tuberculosis. It was May, and they had turned the heat off. It got cold again, and women who were having seizures, methadone withdrawal, and one sister who they said had pneumonia all piled blankets on their beds. The sister got worse and worse. Finally, they brought her to Elmhurst Hospital, where they discovered she did have tuberculosis. I found this out later when she was returned to Rikers, kept in isolation, and the doctors wore masks and gloves when they visited her. I also had Manilia, a vaginal discharge, which worsened because the Montefiore hospital doctors assigned to Rikers could not agree about how it should be treated. They refused to treat the condition at all until my culture was returned from Elmhurst Hospital. By the time they managed to get the culture back, the whole inside of my thigh was chapped raw from the discharge, and I could barely walk. Montefiore Hospital and the Health and Hospital Corporation went to court to prevent Dr. Garrick from delivering my baby. Their position was that since I was a prisoner, it was not necessary for me to have the doctor of my choice. They also said he was disruptive because when he did manage to see me, he often wrote in my chart, which they found very disturbing. The court upheld them. I was only a prisoner. I went into labor the morning of September 10, 1974, at 4 a.m., on 2 Main at Rikers, where I had been kept in the psycho ward. I got out of bed, took a shower, braided my hair, and packed. My labor was mild, a pinch every half hour, which rapidly became a pinch every 15 minutes. At 11 a.m., I was sure I was on my way, but I had no doctor to confirm it, and I refused to go to the infirmary. Around noon, I asked to call Dr. Garrett, and they somehow got hold of him. He was at Elmhurst Hospital, trying to persuade them to let him deliver my baby. At about 3 p.m., he arrived at Rikers, and I went up to the infirmary to meet him. He told me that I was effaced and definitely in labor. I would not allow the other doctors there to examine me. I was taken to Elmhurst Hospital